Hello and welcome to The Dirt, NFCA podcast presented by Netting Professionals. We are thrilled to bring you weekly podcasts covering a wide variety of topics from industry leaders. You can listen to all our past episodes through Apple iTunes or anywhere you listen to podcasts. We are glad you are joining us today. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dirt NFCA podcast. We are back this week talking pitching. Excited to have Coach Erica Hanrahan with us. Coach, for people who don't know you, maybe aren't familiar with you or your program, can you take just a couple minutes and tell us a little bit about yourself, where you coach, and how you got into the game?
Well, sure. Thanks, first of all, for having me on here, and I'm excited to talk to you today. I coach right now at DePaul University in Greencastle, Indiana, which is about 45 minutes west of Indianapolis. And it's a Division III program. And I've been here, I'm now in my 10th year. Prior to this, I was with one of my former players from travel ball in high school who coached at Boston College for a year. And prior to that, I was coaching high school and travel ball in the Chicagoland area. And before that, I actually was in college. So you can imagine how old I am. I'm not going there, but that's kind of my story.
We won't talk about that at all. That's not a problem. We won't even bring that up. You know, one thing I love about all your different experiences, and that's going to bode really well in this conversation, is we know how important pitching is. And it's different developing pitching along the way, but it's also really similar. So I'm excited to get into some of these topics and what's different for different levels of play and what stays, you know, very much the same. I think, you know, starting, if we just start where we are, so your team's been training a little bit, we can get into that. But when you first come back in the winter, after the winter break, what does your practice and workout schedule look like for your pitching staff?
You know, it's a great question. And just to touch back on how you started that question, I have my cousin is a professional pitching coach in Chicago. Her name is Abby Hanrahan. And so she coaches kids as young as 8U all the way up to 18. And so the opportunity to get to talk to her all the time about her experiences and how the year progresses from 8U to 18U. And obviously, I was able to coach travel at different levels in high school. And being at Division III and Division I as both a, you know, player and a coach, the truth is that the year is the year, right? Softball is predominantly played in spring and summer as folks' main season, and then fall has become a little bit more recruiting heavy. But I'd say January, regardless of what level you are at, you're really gearing up for the spring season, which for all of us in college is our primary season. And so the mechanics that you were covering and maybe the fall to tweak some things and make yourself either faster or have a better change of speed or add a pitch or get a little bit more creative with some things, that time has gone. You're getting ready to be successful in competition. And so learning how to get ready for the stamina of games. In college, we play several doubleheaders and several games back-to-back days. So getting in the position to be able to do that effectively from day to day or game to game, I think January is where we start to build the stamina and start to get competition ready. So the tweaks of mechanics or building on speed or changing things are done. And so I think January is, you know, a very important month to gain confidence and stamina. And I think that's where your workouts are geared so that you have confidence for the game and the competitions that are upcoming.
And you know, when you think about the stamina piece, you know, I'm sure pitchers come in with different backgrounds of what they did over the last 4, 6, 8 weeks, whatever it might have been in your schedule. How do you get into that mode, but still being very cautious of arm health and rest and recovery in terms of workload?
And I think that's the key question. I think it's a great question. I think all of us as pitching coaches have to be very honest that everybody comes in January at a different place. I have a pitcher on my staff currently that really hates taking any time off. And when she gets back in January, if I do the same thing with her as I do with my other pitchers who I know use December as more of a resting time after the fall, that's not appropriate for her. right? And it's not appropriate to push them to the same level that this other young lady is at who likes to gear up in December. And so I think as long as you build trust and rapport with your pitching staff where they can be honest with you of where they're coming in, you have to change what you're doing. I think the bands and like the J bands that they have, band work, and the fact that our program and many programs work out strength and conditioning year round, it helps get back into shape a little quicker, but you have to start slowly with those who've been off, you know, having every other day at maximum for those that have taken a little bit more time off is important for those first couple of weeks. Whereas the kids who may have been going a little heavier, you can maybe do 100 pitches or less 5 days a week. And I think that's really important just to find out where your pitchers have been and what they've been doing in late November and all of December to figure out how to start with each of them. So it's not a cookie cutter process and everybody's, you know, everybody's at a different place.
Absolutely. And, you know, your team's at a different place too. And so when you talk about team practices, how do you start planning? All right, here's a bullpen day. Here's a pitching live day. Here's a rest and recovery day. What does that look like? Once you've assessed their individual needs, how do you try to balance them working on skill and confidence and them working on competition?
Absolutely. Awesome question. So I think you work with them in a bullpen on the first day and you find out, you're able to see pretty quickly because you've worked with them all fall where they're really coming in, right? So you have these honest conversations and then you see where they're at. So then you get to judge from what you see on day one bullpen on, okay, how quickly can I put this player, this pitcher into some live pitching circumstances versus how many days do I want to do maybe a short bullpen versus pitching live against batters? And you don't have too much time to progress them into pitching against live batters because that's where they have to have their confidence grown in practice and see what's working and work on the best pitch calling schemata and work with different batters in terms of what their strengths and weaknesses are in hitting so that you have that and you feel confident going into games when you face all these different types of batters. But you have to build the confidence first. So depending on where they are, you know how long you need to go just bullpen versus how quickly you can start transitioning them into more of the live scenarios with your own team so that they can gain that confidence to be like, okay, I'm game ready. And, you know, usually for us, our first real sets of games are mid to late February. So you've got about a month. And I'd say most Division III teams have, you know, a month to 6 weeks to get ready for that. And I think at Division I or Division II, it may be a little bit different. They might start a little earlier. So what we do might be a little bit different in terms of what maybe some other levels look like.
Sure. And, you know, when you're practicing, obviously your geographic location isn't going to allow you to be 70 and sunny in those February days. I mean, just not part of global warming be darned. It's just not there. So, you know, what does it look like when you're inside versus outside? Are those different environments for pitchers? Are there things you try to do to take care of your pitchers when they may be inside, or is it really not that different?
No, it is different. And actually probably the thing that changes the most is the mound. And so I know you alluded to, we got a little bit of a different start this year than usual. So our team has been planning a trip to Hawaii since it got cut short in 2020 that we were going to do for spring break, first Division III tournament out there. And after that got cut short, we worked with our school on it being a winter term. We have kind of a J-term study abroad month, so to speak, at DePauw. And so that's what we just did. And boy, is it different getting to start on the dirt outside in January versus starting in the gym floor. The footing is totally different on a mound, right? You're working with different dirts, different drags, different pitchers being on different mounds versus the hard floor stays the hard floor. So I think that footing is much easier for pitchers inside. And it is a difficult transition when you first get outside to a bullpen. So I do think it may have helped us a little bit, one, being in the heat. So with muscle, right, warm up and everything as they're just getting started and immediately going on to a ground that they are going to be more game ready unless you're playing on turf. So I do think that there is a difference on geographically where you start with pitchers. And so when you're indoors, you're going to work on different things and focus on different things than maybe you do outside mechanically. And it will take a little bit of adjustment when you finally do go outside in the dirt, if you've been in a gym where you don't have wind and you don't have the ground being different. So I do think you're right in saying that the Midwest, it's a little bit of a different training. You know, you're still going to work on the same things, but you have to be aware that there's a gradual getting better process as you go to the outdoors and start game competition.
A message from our official sponsor, Netting Professionals, improving programs one facility at a time. Netting Professionals specializes in the design, fabrication, and installation of custom netting for backstops, batting cages, dugouts, BP screens, and ball carts. They also design and install digital graphic wall padding, windscreen, dugout benches, and more. Contact them today at 844-620-2707 or visit nettingpros.com. Follow at Netting Pros on social media for their latest projects. Now, back to the podcast.
Yeah. And you know, that's funny. We had a pitcher when I was at Central Michigan and she was fantastic, you know, pitcher of the year kind of kid. But she always struggled when we went outside right away, illegal pitch wise. And it was the pitching plate, the mound that was so different and it always baffled me, you know, as someone who spent their life trying to avoid pitchers and pitching coaches and instruction of pitchers, I never really understood until I dug into that a little bit more, but it is something that you have to keep your eye on. Are there things that you do with your pitchers to try to help them understand the differences or, you know, help them with whether it's just awareness or feel or just some things that will increase their patience with themselves, if nothing else?
Well, I think that there is definitely a confidence when you are in the indoors on a ground that's pretty level. You can have a repeatable motion and step and landing, and that's great for the confidence, right? That's the number one piece going into competition that you have to have. But I think if we can get players, even in the Midwest, on those, you know, shocking high 40 days or low 50 days that we kind of can get here and there, we got to find a time to get outside to a bullpen if we have that available to us. Or if it's the first time that you're outside when you're in the game, taking some extra time to just feel the dirt and ground and allow them to make that drag and set it up and regain their confidence, learn how to talk to them. I think that's kind of really the key to being successful and also telling them, hey, there's going to be a little bit of a learning curve here on this first weekend, and that's okay. Here's what our goals are going to be for this first weekend, and we're going to build our resilience and how to get out of some jams. And maybe we might have a couple extra balls, or the location might be a little bit different, but let's rely on our movement or change of velocity when we get into these situations. And so I think just because you are in situations that are different, I mean, it really teaches you to be resilient and adaptable to whatever the game situation throws you into. So I do like being in the Midwest for that reason, because I think it teaches your kids resilience and adaptability pretty quickly early on. And if you are in the indoors, it helps build their confidence because they're able to have that repeatable motion from a ground level that's pretty stable and not going to change. So you just got to use your advantages and use, you know, what could be looked at as a disadvantage to building resilience and using some different skills, right? Some kids use their change of speed only when they're ahead in a count. Maybe they now are going to use it a little bit more frequently because they can't locate quite as well as they're used to off of that hard surface till they get used to the dirt outside. So I think we have the opportunity to teach a lot of different things early on, even shifting from the Midwest cold indoors to the outside.
For sure. You know, one of the questions we get a lot on pitching any scenario where we are doing instruction with coaches is the purpose of a warm-up. And so can you walk us through, Erica, kind of what your pitchers do on just a typical, I'm coming for a bullpen workout versus I'm preparing for a game day? What's similar? What's different? And ultimately, what are you hoping your pitcher gets out of their warm-up no matter what they're getting ready to do?
Right. I think that the number one thing, being a pitcher myself growing up, is getting your body warm, right? So whether we're inside and it's, you know, 60 in our field house, or it's, you know, 55 outside, the number one thing is to have an idea of what you need to do to jog and stretch with your bands and actually get your body ready. I think that's more important than any pre-pitch scheme, whether you like to do Ks or spins, or if you're someone that likes to more quickly get into it, or you like to long throw. I think every pitcher is a little bit unique. I try to get all of our pitchers to have an abbreviated warm-up so that in games, if you need to make a quick switch, they have a warm-up that helps them. But the key is having them practice what it feels like to have your body totally warm. Because once your body's totally warm and your arms are ready to go, in addition to that, with, like I said, I like to use the J-bands. I think that you can get ready very quickly. So what does that warm up look like? I think is what's similar is how they get ready to get their body heated up, right? So it's a jog. And it can be as long as it needs to be until they are actually feeling warm in whatever clothes that they're wearing, whether it's indoors or outdoors. They actually have to get a little bit of a sweat going. Once they've done that, then they can get into their arm care routine, their prehab with that. And then their bodies are in a position to really start to throw, as opposed to it being painful or you can't really feel your hands. You want to avoid all of that to happening. In terms of getting into what drills we like to do to warm up, that is different from pitcher to pitcher. And that's something that I learn with them every fall. What are the things that really work for them to warm up? And then we add a couple things, and then they'll take some things that they learn from us and add to their warm-up routine. But you definitely don't want to pitch a game before a game. So I still say the most important thing is to get your body totally heated and then keep those reps to a minimum to where you're just feeling confident mixing. So you're game ready to go in, whether it's a bullpen session or an actual live competition.
Now, how about your catcher? When your catcher is warming up the pitcher, what are some things that you expect of the catcher, whether it's communication with the pitcher, whether it's communication with you after the fact in a game day or in a competitive setting? What is their role in a bullpen or in a pregame warmup?
That's an awesome thought, because the catcher is so critical to it working. You have to have the trust with your catcher almost as much, if not more sometimes, than you do with your pitcher, because they have to know that they can be honest with you. And every catcher has a different personality. Some don't care whether the pitcher knows exactly what they think too. Some have a little bit like, hey, I got to stay on good, you know, terms. Can you take the heat for it? But if they know that they can be honest with you of like what is working or what isn't, and you know, when it's time to pull, I think that's really important. We also like to get our catchers prepared. So the pitchers know, you know, pregame, yes, they're getting warmed up and the catcher's getting to see and work on, you know, their framing and receiving. And, but they also have to get them ready for different blocks and picks and throwdowns too. So we don't forget our catchers, and we have to build that rapport and that trust with our catchers so that they can say, hey, coach, I know our curveball's her best pitch, but today it's pretty flat. But the rise ball's jumping a lot and the change of speed looks great. And that really helps me know, okay, how are we going to start this off so that the pitcher starts successful? Because a start that's successful for a pitcher, right, that first inning goes well, it usually sets the tone for the rest of the game. But if that goes bad, sometimes it can mess with their psyche. And a great catcher who's in tune with their pitcher and has trust in you, that's worth its weight in gold.
Now, when you are looking at your pitchers and your catchers, are you intentionally trying to help them work with one another frequently? Are you mixing and matching? Are there certain catchers and pitchers who predominantly work with one another? How do you work through that over the course of a year?
You know, I think that is important to figure out pretty quickly. So we have different pitchers on our staff and always have. We'll always have some kid that has a ton of spin, and they might be different speeds. You know, right now we have a kid who throws low to mid 60s with a lot of spin. And so some catchers haven't ever caught that before. And so you have to get them used to catching someone like that. Others have caught, you know, a lot of drop ball pitchers, so they're really good at blocking and picking, and others have rarely seen that. So you have to get them used to it. So I think the fall is the time that you get all of your catchers used to the differences in pitchers, and you watch critically as a coach to see if someone's still struggling with something, so that when you're putting it together, you know, we definitely have catchers that are going to throw more runners out and others that are going to steal some more strikes because they're fantastic receivers, and others that are going to block everything in the dirt and pick everything that comes their way. And so you find out what that comfort level is, and some are good with all of it. And a lot of it is familiarity. And I think it's our job, because you want to be able to use the catcher that's going to help your pitcher look the best and also stop the other team's strengths, right? In any situation. So getting all the catchers to be comfortable with the different styles of pitcher is your job as a coach, to make sure that you're getting them enough reps with the different pitchers. So I don't like to, especially in the fall, have any particular matchups, so that everybody can learn different pitcher strengths, and the pitcher can get used to being caught by different catchers. And I think I was really benefited by that as a pitcher myself growing up. Our coaches naturally just rotated catchers for us. And so I learned how to communicate, and they learned how to communicate with me. And I didn't ever feel stuck then when I went to college and had a different catcher or a couple different catchers. And so I think it's important that we get used to working with different personalities. And along the way, obviously, the rapport, you're going to find out what works best, you know, but you don't want that to be too early on that you have a definite pitcher and catcher that are a duo, so that you have options. And we never can control if someone gets injured or hurt, and that duo could get split up. So you want to make sure that the entire pitching and catching staff have a rapport with each other that you as a coach also are aware of, and can pair them up together pretty effectively.
Yeah. And does that same philosophy come into play when you talk about the communication of, you know, you mentioned it earlier, hey, the rise ball looks great, curveball maybe not so much today, or, you know, in the middle of a game, you know, they're really struggling, you know, with the drop ball, I think we can throw that more? Or is that coming from both pitcher and catcher in game of what's working, what's not? And are you calling pitches, or is your catcher battery doing that together? What's your overall philosophy, I guess, really is the question, on in-game pitch calling and how it works throughout the course of the contest?
Yes. So I always allow the pitcher, and actually encourage the pitcher, to shake me off if they feel uncomfortable with a pitch, or they feel like there's something that they know that would work better at that moment, whether it's a confidence issue or they just can see it. And as a former pitcher, I know that feeling, right? The catcher also, if I call something that they don't think is right, they're going to flash me back a number. And what that number means is, hey, coach, you just called an inside pitch and this kid's far off the plate. So that's going to be right in their wheelhouse. So basically the catcher's letting me know, bad call, not the right call in this situation. And so I also have a sign that says, you call this pitch, right? I know sometimes the catcher has a better vision, or it's the second time through the order, they're getting to see the pitcher from a different angle. And it's an experienced catcher, one that has a really good feel for that particular pitcher, or just the game of softball. And so we will switch it up. Now, I have all the information of scouting in front of me, and the kids don't have the opportunity to spend that much time watching video, right? So the first time through, I'm calling, but that doesn't mean that the pitcher still doesn't have the autonomy to shake me off. And some of them do often, and some of them rarely do, because they like to work fast. And we have a communication that, you know, hey, what do you like to do to start off batters? If, you know, what's your favorite call on the first pitch? How do you like to get ahead? If you're in a jam, what do you like to call? So that's something that we talk about ahead of time with the catcher. So both the catchers and the pitchers know this. We develop this in the fall, and then come spring, hopefully we've got this down, and we've also practiced it in kind of our live scrimmage or live, you know, batter situation prior to getting into a game. But I want the pitcher and catcher to feel totally comfortable telling me, hey, I want to throw something else, or hey, I suggest this. And then we have signs that allow the catcher to call in certain situations as well. So I think having all of those as options is really important. And again, the trust that I'm not going to be mad if you shake me off and that kid gets a hit. They got to know it's okay to make that mistake, because there's plenty of times I call a pitch that they get hits on, right? So we all have to take responsibility for that. And at the end of the day, the pitcher and catcher are sitting in a position that they see things a little bit differently than I do. So just because I have a scouting report, that's usually helps us the first time through, but they can add even more, I think, as the game goes on, and I want them to.
I love that, especially the ability to communicate with the signal back. I think so often that's, you know, where we get a little bit thrown, is that, okay, what is the pitcher thinking, the catcher thinking, the coach thinking, and being able to simplify that of, no, you take this one, or this is what I'm thinking, or, you know, the catcher coming back to not so much. I think that's gotta just help in communication. And we talk about it all the time, right? The key to coaching is communication and being able to have that understanding of one another. What's the between inning dialogue look like, Erica? Is it something that, you know, is retrospective, or is it something that you're looking at the next time up? Is it both? And, you know, you don't have a lot of time there. So how does that work?
You know, as a person that also coaches third base, it is not as long lasting as I'd like it to be. However, prior to going out to the third base box, there are times that I need to talk to our pitcher, maybe more at length. Now, we keep a pretty in-depth pitching chart, and there are certain goals that we want them to hit that we're specifically looking for, that they immediately go to the chart to take a look at, or they'll refer back if it's the second time through the order, what happened the first time through and what pitches worked, how long was the bat. And I've got that in front of me too, but there are times I need to talk to both the pitcher and the catcher. And I'm lucky to have Gabby as my assistant, who is in her fifth year with me. And she played for me for 4 years. And by the way, she also played in my travel organization where I got to coach her for a year. So I'm totally comfortable with her coaching third. In fact, if she ever got to the point where she was like, hey, can I start doing it more often? I'd hand it over to her gladly. So we have those conversations, but I think, you know, we have a lot more before the game and during the week. Here are our goals that we're looking for. And they know exactly to go to that chart and say, okay, how am I measuring up here? And then we'll sometimes talk prior to going out, after we come back in from being on offense, and like, you know what, I'd like to attack this batter inside a little bit more aggressively this time through. My fastball is really feeling good today, and I think I can throw hard and kind of overwhelm her and get in on her hands, right? So that communication changes with the pitcher, with their experience, and with the team, with the score of the game, and how comfortable the pitcher is with going back to those charts, right? Freshman, it takes a little longer. You have to guide them through it. So does the catcher. But once they get to their sophomore, junior, and senior year, they've usually developed that comfort level with communication with both me, the catcher, and with the charts that we're keeping so that they can really track it. And, you know, you did mention one thing about the catcher signaling back. They also signal back to me. So we call a pitch in a location. They signal back to me every time a pitcher is off their spot with where they actually threw it, so that's also marked, so that we don't think, oh, I can't call that pitch again if they just missed the spot, right? So you want to have clear and accurate information so that everybody is not working, you know, is working with the facts, so that we can do our best to call, you know, a great outcome for the next time we see that batter.
And I say this in every podcast that the topic can remotely come up. I think one of the most difficult things to do is make a pitching change. I think that's something that's just really a hard choice to make, and for a variety of reasons. But what are some of the thought processes that you go through of when you're making a change? Who are you asking? What signs are you looking for? You know, when is it gut versus science? And how do you process the whole package of making that decision?
That's a loaded question. And I think it is one that all of us as pitching coaches struggle with, because we're human and not robots. And I think that is important to know, like, you want to give your pitchers confidence and experience being resilient in tough jams, but you also don't want to put your team at a deficit, right? So you want to make sure that you're making the changes when it's appropriate. And that's what you've got a staff for. And I think the first thing is understanding that it's going to be different of the circumstances of when you're going to take certain pitchers out versus another. So for instance, I think it's really important to clearly communicate with your pitchers and your pitching staff so that they all know like the truth about each other. So for instance, we have three pitchers that I call contact to out pitchers. And that means that people are making frequent contact with them, and it may be ground balls, fly balls, whatever, but they're not getting the amount of swings and misses that two of our other pitchers are getting, right? And so you're not going to take the swing and miss pitcher out in the same circumstances necessarily that you are the contact out pitchers, because they can generate an out by a strikeout and in a different way than maybe the contact out can, right? So if you're less than two outs and bases loaded and you're with a pitcher in that is contact out, that might not be the best thing for your team. And so I think having some clear scenarios that we talk to and we say, okay, here is what all of our goals are for our pitching staff. And they know that everybody's going for that. Okay, so now here's when I might take the contact out pitchers out of the game. And we clearly mark that. So it might be their third or fourth combined walk hit by pitch of the game early on in the season. And it might be the second later in the season, right? If their pitch count exceeds 18 in two innings total, they're out. There are, you know, runners on second and third with less than two outs, you know, so you communicate with those pitchers what the likely scenarios are for you to be taking them out to put your team in the best position to win. And that everybody, here's how you act to the next pitcher that's coming in and what your behavior in the dugout should look like, regardless of what you're feeling inside, because in that moment, you've got to take self out of it. And we all have to go for the team, right? And each of them are going to be in different circumstances to be the hero or the relief for someone else. And understanding that you're not better or worse if you're a swing and miss pitcher versus a contact out pitcher, but you may have a different role and that's okay. And so I think that communication is extremely important to have with your pitchers before you get into those high emotion situations, because then they know how to deal with them when it happens, as opposed to reacting maybe in a way that isn't going to help their confidence or the staff feel supported when you have to make those pitching changes. And it also helps you as the coach to know what you want to do ahead of time. So when you get in that situation, you feel comfortable making that change more so than if you hadn't communicated on the front end.
No doubt. I think those are great things to keep in mind and just to consider. And I think it's really hard. The only other thing I think that's equally as difficult is deciding on the intentional walk. And this has been, this is the funny question, but pitching coaches who are head coaches, how likely are you to intentionally walk somebody? My personal theory is that it's harder for a pitching coach who's also a head coach, because you just have that, you know, innate, we can get them out. Where do you stand on the intentional walk? Good tool or rarely use it?
Well, I'm going to tell you this. I haven't used it enough. I joke with my assistant coach that we have made NFCA players of the week one, two, three too many times in our career because of me. And what I mean by that is exactly what you just said, where a kid just knocks the ball out of the park against a great pitcher. And we're like, okay, we can get her next time if we do this. And then boom, you know, double off the top of the fence. Like, it's time to intentionally walk her, right? You don't give her that third chance to hit the ball out of the park. And there have been times that we have. So that is definitely something that as I get older and you've learned through experience, that the intentional walk is an important tool when someone absolutely is a better hitter than what the pitcher is that day. And you have to be hats off, because you never want their best to beat you, right? You want to take your chances with someone that you're better matched against. And so you don't overuse it, because you're then putting people on base. That's what I would have to say.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we've all been on that end of, no, we can do this. What are the chances? What are the chances that we can do it?
I agree. You know, me one too many times though, Janice. So I'm going to try not to make an NFCA player of the week this year.
That's a great goal.
On this side.
that's a great goal. Too funny. You know, Erica, let's get back to practice a little bit and pitchers and just designing practices for them and things like simulating pressure and practicing different strike zones and some of the things that, you know, you really need to set up over and over and over to ensure that they're comfortable when it happens in a game. What are some of your favorite ways to do that in practice?
I actually think this is my absolute favorite part of being a pitching coach and my favorite thing as a head coach to create for practices. So this is definitely my strength because it is something that my coaches growing up were ahead of their time with and did this for us all the time. And they did it with like consequence based, like you better get this otherwise. But that then helped us when we went into a game because there was nothing worse than making your fellow pitcher go run a lap or have 10 pushups because you didn't hit that spot, right? But it taught me how important pressure competition is to be in practice so that you have that ability and that adrenaline and how to work through it so you're confident in that pressure in a game. So we actually do it almost every day. And so I think one, it's fun for both the kids and the coaches, right? Because that's why we do this. We love game day, right? We love the competition. So that is a lot of fun to recreate. And so whether it is a two-pitch scrimmage, and what I mean by that, it really isn't two-pitch. So let's say we have a live batter and we've got a field and the pitcher's on the mound. If the first pitch is a strike, the count goes to 1-2. And we play from there. If the first pitch is a ball, the count goes to 3-1 and we play from there. So it teaches the pitchers really to try to get ahead and then how to, if they don't, pitch out of a jam, right? And so that would be one. Another would be in a bullpen, you might play the game of five where you are with, let's say, another pitcher and I call a pitch to a spot and they nail it. You go down to four. That pitcher stays up and the next pitch, they miss totally. They throw it in the dirt. It's a tough pitch for the catcher. That's what I consider a bad miss. So they go up to five and then the next pitcher steps on the mound. If they as collectively get up to 10, then they have some sort of consequence that they're doing and they have to start over again after the consequence. If they get down to zero, boom, day is over. Their pitching workout is over. So we like to do that at the end. And again, it's working with each other as a staff and it is having to hit your spots, having a good miss. You get to usually stay on whatever number you're at. So it shows like you're not going to be perfect all the time, but that pitch isn't going to hurt us in that situation. So, you know, those are some of the ways that we like to do the pressure situations. And then my favorite thing with the team is to, have an 8 to 10 minute clock, depends where you're at in the season and where pitchers are at. And you have everybody line up on the third baseline and they get in the box and we call a pitch. And if the pitcher hits the spot, then that player goes over to the first baseline. If they miss their spot and it's a good miss, the player goes to the end of the line. If it's a bad miss, everybody that had moved over to the first baseline comes back the third baseline and they start again. And so the pitching staff as a whole is trying to get the entire team to get from the third baseline to the first baseline before the clock runs out. And they're working together as a staff. And that also helps with them rooting for each other, right? Like you want them to win because then the team wins. And I think that helps in that way too. And it also, right, it's when your pitcher's on, the team does well behind them, right? So it's an entire team. The batters are also rooting for that to happen. And it also helps with the batters with pitch tracking so that they're getting used to seeing the ball coming at them in different ways and how to react to it. So again, that's one of my favorite things to do for to end practice or, you know, when your pitchers are getting ready to go into a competition the next day or in a couple of days.
Those are really fun. And, you know, I've done a lot of one pitch scrimmages where it's, you know, strike, you're out, ball, you walk. And if it's foul ball, you get one more chance and, you know, keep moving on. But it's interesting to do the two pitch and play from there because it does make it a little more real life. You know, that yes. First pitch being very instrumental in how the rest of the bat will go. And numerically, statistically, we see that that's pretty accurate, indicative of, you know, if you can get the first pitch strike versus if you don't. Do you find that the challenges and contests you're talking about and that pressure, that it helps pitchers understand that good miss versus bad miss? You know, I think sometimes it's, you get 0-2 and you want to get them to chase. And some people will say, why would you do that? You know, you don't want to let them back in the count or some of those things. Has that helped determine the, not really the difference between ball and strike, but the difference between a quality pitch and a not quality pitch?
It's such great questions. First of all, I used to do the one pitch scrimmage. I moved to the two pitch scrimmage because because you're never doing a one pitch scrimmage in the game, right? You want the batters to have the same mentality, right? Where you want to swing at a good pitch, but if they're under so much pressure to not do that, then maybe they end up getting more aggressive than you want them coming into a game. So the two pitch scrimmage helps you play out the counts a little bit better, which is why we do that. The second part of that, can you please repeat it? Because I did have something and it went right out of my head because I told you I'm too old.
This is where I get into trouble, Erica. I warned you about like 30 second long questions. It's on the concept of a good pitch and a bad pitch.
Oh, right.
Good miss, yeah. Bad miss, and balls, yeah, and strikes.
Okay, perfect. So remember when I was talking about the contact to out pitchers versus the swing and miss pitchers? So their quality pitches are different. And so good misses and bad misses are different for them. Also different pitches are different, good and bad misses, right? A screwball shouldn't ever be in the dirt. That's not the way that the spin goes and the catcher isn't expecting it. So when a screwball is in the dirt, that's a bad miss, no matter who's on the mound, swing and miss or contact out. Whereas our swing and miss pitcher, Cammy, who's a first team All-American, she actually throws the ball down the middle with multiple pitches and hits the red zone of the plate and gets swings and misses all the time with different pitches. So for her, a quality pitch isn't one that is down the middle. It's one that doesn't break or one that is in the same zone as she just threw so that the batter can, you know, do make that adjustment quickly versus the contact out pitcher. Yeah. When you throw it in the red zone, maybe that ball doesn't have as much break and you're not getting swings and misses. So that's going to be a tough one. So I think quality pitches is different for what your pitcher and on that staff is most effective in getting outs for your team. So I think, again, that communication of who you are and how you help the team and what a good miss and a bad miss is for you isn't necessarily the same for every pitcher on your staff.
Great points. And, you know, when you think about some of those drills and some of those concepts you're using, those are fantastic. And are there any other things in practice that you do that you just absolutely love? If somebody called you and said, hey, I need your favorite drill that you can explain without any video, without any diagrams, give me one more. What else would you suggest that a pitching coach or a coach try?
You know, I think that something that is really important is we all have downtime or dead time where we don't get to be with our pitchers. And it's really important that they can have some good workouts on their own that you're not developing entirely for them, or they know how to take themselves through. And so one that's easy to explain, audio versus, you know, having to actually show a drill how it works, is I call it the 30 pitch chart. Okay. So, I have our kids when they leave 30 pitches that half of them, actually 20 of them are to righties and 10 of them are to lefties. And I think that's important because that's about the breakdown of what we tend to see in terms of live batters against them. And I put together pitches to locations for that 30 pitches that they're likely to get called. And so you're repeating some of the same pitches. Obviously we don't have 30 different pitches, but where we're throwing those pitches and maybe what comes after that sequence. And next to each pitch is hit, good miss, bad miss. And they are tracking whether they have a hit, good miss, bad miss. And regardless of what happens, they go to the next sequence, right? They go to the next pitch. And at the end, they tally it up. How many hits do they have? How many good misses do they have? How many bad misses they have? And we know with that our ultimate goal would be to have an 80% hit and 20% good miss and 0% bad miss. That's really hard. That's a very high standard, but I always believe you want to shoot for higher than maybe even what's real, right? So that, you know, you shoot for the stars and you might catch the moon, right? So they're able to, you know, do that maybe once a week during that off season and see their progress of getting better. And that's one of the first things in the first days of bullpen I'll have them do, because it's something easy that they could have worked on in the off season. And there's nothing more important than locating your pitches and being able to nail what you do well. And it's a way for them to showcase to us, or it's a quick bullpen. And sometimes what we'll do is we'll warm up and do that. And if they get to their best yet of the year, the bullpen's over. Or if they, you know, really, you know, don't do very well on it, then we take a look at what pitches they were struggling with, or if it's a mechanical concept or something that we can help them with, and we focus on that in the rest of the bullpen. So that would be something that I say has that our pitchers love, they can take with them, and that you can use at any point in the year, you know, as you go along.
Well, thank you very much, Erica. This has been a lot of fun and really interesting. I think a lot of things that some coaches can take and put back with their pitchers. And we always end our podcast in the same way. We ask for a piece of advice. So for you, talking to fellow coaches about pitching development, getting pitchers ready, whether it's game management, no matter which direction you want to take the question, what piece of advice would you give to your fellow coaches and pitching coaches for this point in the year as they look forward to the season?
Think about the most, you know, the toughest opponents that you've had year in and year out. And maybe as pitching, you know, they always have a great staff, and find a time to network and pick their brain. I have the best network of people out there in coaching for all different things, not just pitching. And it is all of the reason for our success is it is a team. And I love softball and the NFCA because I feel like people in the same conference can turn into best friends and they're respected. And as long as we're curious and keep growing, a lot of times that opponent can turn into your really good friend, but you also can learn so much from them. So I'd say, you know, as you get into it, I've had, even at the NFCA convention recently, some of our most, you know, heated rivalries, you get into a conversation with those people, they want to share and they want to help you. And it's all about making the players better. And I think it also develops relationships and connection, and it grows our game. So I don't know if that's exactly the answer you're looking for, but it is definitely the greatest gift I have is the relationships I have with my fellow coaches who've taught me more than I could have ever learned otherwise.
I think that's a great piece of advice, and I hope people take that to heart and continue networking, growing the game, being willing to share and give back. And, you know, somebody told me once, you can't get another good idea unless you give the first one away, that they just don't work that way. And I think that's awesome. And so many of our coaches do that really well, of being willing to share and grow together. So appreciate those words. And thank you again so much for joining us. It's been a ton of fun.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you. You got my juices flowing about softball, and I can't even wait to get to practice the next time. So thank you to you.
Perfect. Well, you are welcome. For those of you that are listening, we are back next week, another brand new episode of The Dirt. We're going to be talking about parenting during the season, how difficult that can be, time management, and just all things taking care of yourself, your family, and your team. If you are looking for more topics, don't hesitate. Jump in the archives, check those out. And if there's something that you're looking for and you don't think we have it, let us know. Love to explore new topics that you want to hear more about. You can reach us via email, education@nfca.org, or any of our social media channels, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, you name it, or pick up the phone and give us a call. We are here Monday through Friday and would love to hear from you. Until next time, this has been Joanna Lane, Senior Director of Education in The Dirt, NFCA podcast presented by Netting Professionals.
Thanks again for listening to The Dirt, NFCA podcast presented by Netting Professionals. We encourage you to let us know what topics you would like covered in future episodes. Join us again next week for another exciting podcast.